It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. How do you talk with an aging parent about getting some help in day-to-day living or whether they should move out of their home and into a retirement community or a care facility, and acknowledging that it's their decision to reassess their living situation and ultimately decide if they want to move and to where? Call in at any point about senior living and sensitive transitions. Join in with a question or a comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Gregory Henriksen is a clinical professor in the Department of Geriatrics and Palliative Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and a Fort Atkinson native, I must add. Greg, welcome to the Ideas Network. Welcome back to Wisconsin.
I'm happy to be there.
Well, let's talk about here in Wisconsin, nearly 125,000 Wisconsinites who are 85 years and older. That's from our Department of Health Services data. What are common factors that lead someone to consider not living independently or, say, moving to assisted living?
Well, it's typically the accumulation of health problems that make it more difficult to live at home and take care of the things that you need to take care of. It may be memory-related problems or some combination of them. And at some point for some people, they have to consider that possibility, or it's being recommended to them by healthcare providers or family members.
Why should a person moving to, say, assisted living be part of the decision-making process? What is that like for the older person?
Well, they're the central person in the decision-making process. If the issue is raised by a family member, it may be a difficult conversation. And it may be the first time the older person has seriously considered that as an option. And it typically takes time for people to get their heads around that possibility. Or I might hasten to add, it may be sometimes recommended on the part of a family member who is misreading the level of capability of the older person to live independently. And that recommendation actually may not be a good one.
How do you have a productive and honest conversation about senior care when your loved one may not be ready for that conversation or feels threatened by a move like that?
You would probably want to start in a very soft sort of way and raise some concerns about how the person is doing, and then ask them about what their own thoughts are about that, to potentially get the dialogue moving. Saying something like, "Mom, you need to move to a nursing home," is not the best way to start a conversation.
No, it sounds like it really needs to start with a lot of listening and just some openings, like, you know, maybe like, just how are you doing? Do you know whether they feel anxious or do they feel concerned about their living environment, and, you know, whether they even feel lonely? What are those emotions like?
Well, obviously, it depends upon the person and what they're experiencing. I mean, for some people who are having difficulties with functioning, that is, their health problems impair their ability to go about doing the things that they enjoy and they like. And if that's the case, for some people, they can become increasingly isolated. People who had a wide range of social and family engagements and now find themselves spending increasing amounts of time at home. For some individuals, perhaps much to their surprise, may find moving away from their home of many years into a residence where there are other people may in fact afford opportunities for easy socialization that map onto the way they usually related in the world, in which will bring them a greater sense of well-being rather than being isolated at home.
I'm going to reintroduce you here as we talk about senior life transitions with Greg Henriksen, who's a clinical professor in the Department of Geriatrics and Palliative Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. You can join in about senior living transitions, your questions, your experiences. They're welcome at 800-642-1234. Greg, what changes occur to family dynamics when an aging person starts to need extra daily support?
Well, it probably depends on the previous historical family dynamics, which, speaking for myself, are often have their upsides and their downsides. And so if, for example, you have had a conflicted relationship with an adult daughter throughout much of your life, that conversation is probably going to be much more complicated, and the dynamics of that also more complicated. You know, part of the challenge is that if you're an older adult who many people have had children, you're used to the role of being the parent. And so when one of your adult children begins to recommend things to you in a way that seems to run against what you historically your role has been in the family, that can be uncomfortable for both individuals. What also comes into play in families in which there are more than one child is that historical rivalries or difficulties or alliances or good feeling among siblings may also come into play in both positive and negative ways. And sometimes when a parent is having problems, those dynamics will arise for better or for worse.
Do you encounter the situation where the elderly person doesn't have the adult children or a support network around them? How do you ensure that that goes smoothly when there isn't the adult children in the picture?
That's such a good question. And I live in New York City, and as part of my work, I and my colleagues do collaborative projects with some community housing programs where there are social workers who, in fact, talk with us about older adults who have no involved family members. There may be people who have no adult children but have other involved family members or close friends. But there are individuals, which is sometimes called the unbefriended elderly, who then may get themselves in complicated situations in which social service professionals may have to play a facilitating role for individuals who may need to move into other kinds of settings.
What about aging in place as an option? What are your tips on how to know whether the home would work for the end years?
Well, you know, it depends upon what kind of home you have. I live in New York City, where most of us live in apartments.
Yes.
I live in a large apartment building with a doorman. I have relatively few demands on my if I have something that's broken in my apartment, I call the superintendent. But many people live in their own single family homes. And as for those of us who have owned homes, they require, you know, a lot of attention and a lot of work. And for some people who are getting into their advanced years, that just may be too much to handle the people who have to fix things and come in and the roof and all that stuff. So in the end, a person may find that living in an apartment kind of arrangement is going to be less stressful and actually provide opportunities for greater levels of independence than living in the traditional family home, which requires a whole array of responsibilities to keep it up.
We have clinical psychologist Greg Henriksen guiding our conversation on aging in place, as we've been talking about, holding on to independence and those senior living transitions. You can join in with your experience, your thoughts. You can ask a question. Call in at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks to Francis in Watertown for calling in and suggesting this conversation about senior living and framing it with the key tension points, telling us
the question is, you know, where do I want to be? Who do I want to live near? What kind of living situation is right for me? And the big question is, who decides and when?
Let's explore those questions. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have clinical psychologist Greg Hinrichsen is a professor in the Department of Geriatrics and Palliative Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. Greg, Pew Research says that more than 17 million people are caring for an aging parent. And I'm wondering if you can talk about those dynamics and how family members are helping their aging elders with a loss of independence?
Well, I think the first thing to remember is that most older adults who have adult children depend upon their children to be available to provide care. It doesn't mean it's not going to be complicated for both parties. And it's sort of, and it depends upon what kind of care is needed. Part of the challenge is, where do you draw the line between, or the tension between independence and safety? And it's not always entirely clear. And sometimes older adults complain to me that their children are hovering over them. And sometimes adult children complain that their parents are underestimating the level of difficulties they're having, and they express concerns about safety. So there are many people who are providing care providing care to older adults, but also to younger individuals too.
The sandwich generation.
Yes.
Can you talk about those concerns with people who are simultaneously caring for elderly parents and their own children at the same time?
Well, one of my colleagues coined the term women in the middle of their lives and in the middle of working, providing, raising their children and providing care to an aging parent who may need care. There can be many stresses, but let's not also forget there are many rewards that come to people who are providing care to older family members. And I think we sort of forget that, and that people sometimes feel that when providing care that they didn't realize how strong they could be, or how capable they could be, or how much satisfaction they feel from doing the right thing, which is providing care to family members in a way that they hope for themselves in their later years they will receive.
You also have to think about what care that older person might need when they are living with you. Is it, you know, moving them from a chair to a bed, or helping them get dressed, or bathing? And so I feel like you have to have some really honest awareness of what you can take on as a person in those situations as the parent ages.
Yeah, a minority of people live with their adult children. And if you're finding that you're now in the role of being a caregiver, it's like a new job with a new set with a new job description, with a new set of responsibilities and skills for which you would not presumably be prepared. So part of it is a learning curve on the part of the person who is maybe providing care of one sort or another, and also trying to discern whether at some point additional help is needed in the home that may be provided by a formal care provider.
I think about all of this and how timing is key here. You know, I've heard from loved ones who are seniors saying they wanted to stay as long as they could, but didn't want to have to make a big move under stress or under duress, like after, say, a fractured hip or something. How should we negotiate the timing piece?
It depends. And sometimes it's not entirely clear what the timing should be. And frankly, for some people who perhaps should have considered getting additional assistance or possibly a move to another kind of living environment, only do it when in fact there's the dramatic incident, the fire in the kitchen, the fall in the home in which person may be on the floor for some extended period of time. And that then becomes the precipitating incident. In principle, the best thing to do is to try to be clear-eyed to the extent you can about what your capabilities are and what your problems are, and then make plans in advance. But that's the ideal. So I think that it's important for all of us who are older to take stock of what our strengths are and where our problems are, and then figure out what might be the best way to proceed based upon that.
Talking about senior life transitions with psychologist Greg Henriksen, a clinical professor in geriatrics and palliative medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. You can join in with your questions about this point in life, 800-642-1234. Greg, the National Library of Medicine says that Black older adults are less likely to move to assisted living and are more likely to move to a nursing home compared to white older adults. What racial disparities exist among access to assisted living facilities?
Well, one explanation for the lower rates of moving to institutions may reflect the durability of family relationships among Black Americans. For those individuals who may want to move to assisted living, for example, it requires resources to do that. I might hasten to add what is called assisted living varies considerably. Nursing homes are a highly regulated industry, and assisted living is usually not. And so typically, if you have less income, you may have fewer choices if, in fact, it seems desired and appropriate to move to a more institutional kind of settings. So there's this tension between historic strong family ties among older African Americans and then resource issues if in fact they want to move to something like assisted living.
I wonder if you can talk about sadness and signs of depression after a senior has moved away from the home they love and has made a transition. And how do you treat that? How do you monitor that?
Well, you know, that is one life transition. Just think about young people who are moving out of their home, their family homes to go to college. That can be a big transition. And for some people, there are emotional ramifications. And for older people who may move into assisted living or nursing home, there is a period of adjustment that would be normal and expectable. And for a minority of people, they may have what we would think of as sort of clinical depression, and for which there are effective treatments, and sometimes there are on-site services that are provided for people. So it's one of many life transitions, and it's one that is more unique to later life.
It strikes me you sound optimistic about this time in life. Do you? How do you feel?
Oh, may I just tell you that research has consistently found that older adults are happier, less depressed, more mature, and have better interactions with other people than younger persons. It's sometimes called the paradox of well-being in later life. In this program, we've been talking about problems, but it's often underestimated the many rewards that come with aging. And I had a patient recently said, Dr. Henriksen, the gifts of aging are highly underappreciated. And I think that's important to keep in mind. And I, as a 72-year-old person who's been in the aging field, would choose no other age than I am right now.
Oh, Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Psychologist Greg Henriksen is a clinical professor in the Department of Geriatrics and Palliative Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we explore mermaid fandom, the evolution of mermaids and pop culture and mystical trends. On TikTok alone, the search term mermaid core has racked up hundreds of millions of views. Join in the conversation. What resonates with you about these mythical creatures? Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Echo is a professional mermaid entertainer and mermaid instructor trainer in Wisconsin with programming for children on mermaid culture and ecology. Echo, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here.
Good morning. Okay, fill us in. Where did your interest in being a mermaid come from?
Yeah, well, I am a Wisconsin native through and through, and I grew up on the St. Croix River, which is the one that runs into the Mississippi. We used to go out on our boat, our family boat, every weekend, every day after school, and I would tie my feet together with boat rope and put on my grandma's flippers and pretend to be a mermaid. And now that I am an instructor, that is the absolute last thing you should do when it comes to safety. But I had a really good time trying to stay underwater as often as I could and as long as I could, and the fascination just sort of grew, and everyone thought I was weird, and now it's my job. So it certainly came full circle, and I'm so glad that it's catching on now, and it's more and more popular every day.
It seems like there is this global community coming together and all of these forums online, like Mern Network. What is that like in the mermaid community?
I am so glad that you mentioned Mern Network. Nobody knows about it. And that's actually how I got started. But that is one of my favorite parts of the mermaid community is the community, right? So I have all these really, really special and cool friends all over the world that I never would have met if it wasn't for this job and this industry. So I have a mentor in Cozumel, Mexico. I have another one in Canada and another one in California. And this job has taken me across the country and across the world and back. And it's all because of the passion for aquatic conservation that each and every one of these merfolk has through and through and all day long. So it's definitely a very fun job and a really tight-knit community.
What do you ask each other? What are conversations like in the community?
We talk a lot about conservation, but we also talk a lot about inclusivity and action and policy. So one of the nonprofits that I work for is called Mermaid at Any Age. I'm a board member, and we talk about how we can increase aquatic conservation. We also talk about how we can increase swimming safety for kids, especially if kids of color don't have access to swimming lessons and swimming pools in the same way that white kids do. We also talk about inclusivity. So how can we represent the mermaid community in a way that is inclusive to folks from all genders, all backgrounds, all races, all sexualities, right? So it's a really community-oriented community, and we're constantly looking for ways to solve the world's problems. We just have fishtails, so we're doing it in a creative way.
What does it take to become a certified mermaid?
That is a really good question and a really important one. And it's definitely my top priority and concern right now. With the rising popularity of mermaiding, we have a lot of people going on sites like Amazon and Wish and just buying a tail for their 7-year-old, you know. And that's not safe, right? There are approved brands out there, but they can be hard to find if you don't know what you're looking for. So getting certified is kind of the step one in doing this correctly. I always say to parents and new merfolk, tails are not toys. They are a tool, and we have to learn how to use them safely in order to have fun, right? So in order to get certified, I recommend PADI. I'm a PADI mermaid instructor trainer, and we do classes here in the Midwest, but I can also travel to you. You can visit my website for more information on that, but I teach kids of all ages. But most of my students are actually adults. And the people who get these certifications are looking to do mermaiding safely and responsibly, but also looking to get the certification so that we can get gigs in a way that is approved by this world-class third-party brand, Patty, right? So without my Patty certification, I wouldn't be able to work at aquariums or, you know, work at larger scale gigs like that.
How does wearing a tail complicate swimming?
Well, for me, not wearing a tail complicates swimming. but it's funny now, if I take off my tail or my monofin, I feel like a fish out of water, which is hilarious. But I think that for somebody who has never tried it before, obviously your legs are bound. So you are in an environment where you might feel kind of stuck your first time you put it on. So that's why it's really important to do this with an instructor or in a safe environment. They are also very heavy. They can be. My silicone tail weighs about 45 pounds dry and about 60 pounds wet. So obviously it's a prosthetic that is going to drag you to the bottom of your environment. And they're also very, very tight. They're custom fit to your body measurements, usually if it's silicone. So you really have to know what you're doing. It's like you wouldn't get in a car without having a driver's license. You certainly should not get in a silicone tail without knowing what you're doing a little bit, you know? So
can you describe the colors? Kind of give us a description of what the costume looks like for our mind's eye.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. So Echo is my character and she is a purple mermaid. So she loves the colors purple and blue and white and opalescence. So the bottom of her tail features a swirl, which is my kind of signature look. And it swirls around my ankles and up the back of the heels. And that represents how I got started mermaiding. So it's kind of a nod to my origins. When I had ankle surgery in 2012 was when I first discovered the mermaid community. And so I represent my recovery from ankle surgery and back into sports and active lifestyle through mermaiding with that swirl around my ankle. But yeah, she's a beautiful purple sparkly princess mermaid. So she's certainly fun to look at.
Wisconsin mermaid entertainer and instructor trainer goes by Echo, helping us understand mermaiding, why these mythical creatures are so revered in pop culture, having a moment. You can bring your mermaid thoughts to the conversation at any point. Call in with a question at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We channel our inner mermaid, reflecting on what to make of mermaid trends and the online communities forming around these mythical creatures that embrace that half-human, half-fish look. Join in with your questions, your observations, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Echo is a mermaid entertainer and instructor in Wisconsin and stays with us. Marcus in Milwaukee has something. Marcus, hi.
Good morning. So I went to UW-Milwaukee. I'm a history major. I have 24 or 42 credits towards a master's. I want to say that to everyone out there, I actually think mermaids may be real. And the reason being is that when we first were able to write down things that were occurring when we first developed writing, there's very few people who could read. And there's even fewer that could write and read. So this stuff wasn't being written down as some of the original stories, just because I think that they were good stories. I think that these were actually things that our ancestors were seeing, because you have such things as the Telekinese off of Greece. You have the Alunta off of Alaska. There's other creatures that have been seen off of Antarctica. You have pictures in the Alaska caves in France. And so I believe just based on the whole, I would say that these are actually real creatures that I don't know if they're still out there, but at some point they were actually out in the waters and our ancestors did see them, because we wouldn't write this down.
Marcus, thank you for that. Echo, can you share insights there?
Well, I think Mark should be a professional mermaid. Certainly knows more about that stuff than I do. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I like to say to my students, mermaids are one of the most special, if not in my humble opinion, the most special cryptid that exists, because we have these discussions today, right? Which is not true for most other cryptids. Are mermaids actually real? And there's a sense of wonder there that still exists that maybe we don't quite have for Nessie, the Loch Ness Monster, or, you know, some of our other friends out there that may or may not be real. So I think it's a really special feature of mermaids, and it's the reason why they're so popular today, for sure.
You have a live show at Discovery World in Milwaukee. What does this show look like?
Yeah, so I am a conservation educator through and through, first and foremost. And what we do is we put that conservation education up front in front of every show. And that is the guiding light that we use to write the show. So I take the script and I write it every show. And then I have a Discovery World employee aquarist who will read the script and go through the show. But each month we cover a different topic. This weekend, we are talking about aquatic access and freshwater access. And our shows are always focused on the Great Lakes and freshwater, because less than 4% of water research on environments are on freshwater environments, and the rest are on marine environments. But as we know, freshwater is a really important resource for humans. You know, we drink it, and we need to be focusing more funding, more policy, more attention on freshwater. So I always try to do that. So freshwater access, what is that? Who has enough water? How are we turning off our sinks when we're not using them? Are we taking showers instead of baths? Who has access to fresh water? Who doesn't? So come along to Discovery World this Saturday and you can learn all about freshwater access and learn it from a mermaid.
Mermaids, a gateway to conservation ethic. Let's go to Lindsay in Westby. Lindsay, hi.
Good morning. I grew up in Florida, and I don't know if you know about Weekiwachi Springs there, where they have the mermaid show. But I was wondering, you know, there they seem to dive very, very deep in their performances. And what is the depth that mermaids dive in Wisconsin?
That's a really good question. So my PR, my personal record, I hit in Cozumel, Mexico, which was 62 feet. Of course, I don't have access to that kind of free diving here in Wisconsin, but typically for Paddy course, we dive about 30 feet. The aquarium I perform in is 24 feet.
How do you interact with the audience when you're doing these sometimes complex tricks underwater? You've got breath, exertion, and you've got people looking at you on the other side of the glass.
Yeah. I like to say that if you think, you know, your job's hard, try doing it blind, hypothermic, and, you know, you can't see anything, you can't hear anything, and you're very, very cold. So that's my job environment. I don't know who's on the other side of the glass. I can't see or hear anything. So I'm just completely trusting my safety team. I give kids what I call mermaid beacons, but they're actually just little ring lights. And that kind of helps me see where people are. But I really have no idea who's there. I've hit my forehead on the glass a couple of times because I really have no visibility. And that's kind of unique to that specific aquarium tank. Sometimes I have better visibility in different tanks, but it's just years and years and years of practice and training and a really good safety team.
How do you keep your makeup and your hair pieces and the whole look of the costume all in place and perfect underwater?
That's a very common question I get on TikTok as well. there's a lot of secrets that I have, and some of them are maybe not so safe. I wouldn't say that they're FDA approved. Like, I use lash extension glue on my fake lashes, but you shouldn't probably do that underwater, you know, little things like that. But I have, it's just years of trial and error. One thing I do that works pretty well is I wear a velvet headband under my wig. I also braid my real hair under my wig and pin the wig to those braids. So there's a lot of things that go into it as far as securing things. But really, my main goal is just nothing, absolutely nothing can come off, right? Because I am responsible for the health and safety of my coworkers, the fish I perform with. So we need to make sure that my costume is fish approved and fish safe.
We're talking about performing as a mermaid with Echo, a mermaid entertainer and trainer in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Shauna in Milwaukee is here. Hi, Shauna. What is your question?
Good morning. So my question is a little bit different than what we've been talking about. I'm wondering about any situations where you've had to deal with, like, being objectified as a mermaid, and how are those handled? I mean, the mermaids are gorgeous, but I wouldn't be surprised if there have been issues that have had to be handled.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. It happens all the time, actually. There hasn't been a time when I've put on my costume and had that hasn't happened, sadly. And it's a really big annoyance for me because I'm there for the kids. You know, I'm there to do my job. I'm there to connect them with fresh water and get them inspired to become the nation's next freshwater steward. So really, I see it now as an impediment towards doing my job. How I handle it is I will do the same kind of thing that Disney princess trained actors will do, which is redirection. If that doesn't work, I'll hand them off to my tender, whoever is with me. But I always bring the focus back to the kids and, you know, just redirect my attention to them and start singing a song or make it fun for them, because really that's who I'm there for.
Why do you choose to work in educating kids and not adults?
Well, it's a really good question. Thanks for asking that. I think that kids are the future, and kids are the next step towards solving the climate crisis. I do work with adults in my day job. I work as a program manager for a nonprofit that works on the Great Lakes. And I tell you, they're a lot less fun to work with, right? There's policy and rules and government and decision making, and none of that has to happen when you're working with kids. When you're working with kids, all you need to do is inspire them. And that can be done through whimsical storytelling and playing games and making jokes and making your face into like a bubble fish face. And they laugh and giggle. And suddenly they're like, oh my God, I have to protect Echo. Like, she's so cute, right? And that's just way, way more fun for me. And I also have seen the example of it working firsthand. I get phone calls back from parents and they'll say, you know, my kid met you 3 years ago. And now anytime I try to take a plastic bag from Target, they yell at me, you know, mm-hmm. We're constantly bringing our reusable bags to the grocery store. So I know it works. And I know that the impact is hit so much harder with kids than with adults. So I think it's really important work. And I'm so grateful to do it.
We only have a few moments left, but I just want to run by Mermaid Corps by you. How do you bring mermaid into your overall look and wardrobe when you're not performing?
Oh, I actually try not to. which makes me maybe different from other merfolk, but when it's your job, you know, you probably wouldn't want to wear your work blazer when you're off, you know? So I don't.
That's fair. That is fair. Echo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Echo is a professional mermaid entertainer and mermaid instructor in Wisconsin, currently pursuing their master's at UW-Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show and Mermaids here on the Ideas Network.